This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The free press, cultural sensitivity, and religious fundamentalism. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Outrage over Danish cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad has turned deadly in Afghanistan, Somalia, and Lebanon. In Europe itself, republication in the name of press freedom has sparked Islamic protests that in turn have provoked anti-immigrant nationalism. On To the Point, worldwide reaction reportedly is being orchestrated by radical clerics. But why are the drawings themselves so offensive? Is freedom of the press unlimited, or does it require restraint? Is multicultural sensitivity really capitulation to religious extremists? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. European cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad have sparked violent protests around the world and raised questions about the free press and religion. On To the Point, do cultural sensitivities require restraint? Is that capitulation to religious extremism? First, this news update. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez told the Senate Judiciary Committee today that both the law and the Constitution permit electronic surveillance of Americans without a court order.
The terrorist surveillance program is lawful in all respects. The president is acting with authority provided both by the Constitution and by statute.
Some of the toughest questions came from Republican Committee Chair Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, who said surveillance without a court order is against the law. Mark Hosendahl watched the proceedings for Newsweek magazine. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
How tough was Mr. Specter on the Attorney General?
Well, it's not just Specter. It's also other Republican senators, Senator Mike DeWine, Senator Lindsey Graham, is now giving him sort of a hard time on the issue of torture and also on the issue of surveillance. And my understanding is there may even be a majority of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which last week was fairly stonewalled by a whole panel of intelligence officials on this issue, that a majority of that committee, which of course is dominated by Republicans, that they want the committee to go beyond what the chairman, Pat Roberts, has done and conduct a serious bout of oversight of the administration's activities in this area. So this is not, I mean, there are Republicans out there stoutly defending the administration, but there are also Republicans like Specter and Lindsey Graham and Mike DeWine who are grilling the administration on this and don't seem to be taking everything that Al Gonzalez says as gospel.
Back to the Judiciary Committee, Senator Specter today apparently said that in order to assure public confidence, because a lot of people are questioning the legality of this, why couldn't the administration take this to the FISA court, so-called, the court established to look into these things?
Well, and the administration's answer to that we didn't just say that. They raised questions as to why the administration didn't come back to Congress to ask that the FISA law, the 1978 Watergate law banning domestic surveillance wiretapping without order from the secret FISA court, why back to Congress and ask for that law to be modified. And Gonzalez basically said, well, that would tip off the enemies, that would tip off Al-Qaeda that you're doing that. And that seems to be the administration's fairly standard answer whenever people raise questions about this and demand further debate, which is, why do you want to help our enemies by debating this in public?
Senator Kennedy, as I understand it, said that it might hinder the war on terror if the courts found that evidence gathered this way was inadmissible in court.
Well, that's one argument, isn't it?
What about the question of war powers? Did the Attorney General hit that pretty hard?
I didn't see that, but I do know that there's been a big argument here, which I reported on in Newsweek to some extent, as to how far the president's powers go. I saw Senator Feinstein start to grill Mr. Gonzalez on that issue. Does the president's powers, and she did this also last week in a secret briefing for the Intelligence Committee, do the president's powers allow them to conduct warrantless searches? Do the president's powers allow them to suspend the Posse Comitatus Act and bring the military involved? And also the issue that I raised in Newsweek this week, do the president's powers allow him to order the killing of a terrorist suspect on United States soil without a warrant, without a trial. And the administration at least has asserted in theory that maybe the president's powers do go that far, although they said that those are not formal opinions.
Talking with Mark Hosenbaugh, the investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. This is To the Point from PRI. Mark, you've also reported in Newsweek that Senator Feinstein, whom you mentioned a moment ago, in this closed-door session of the Intelligence Committee, asked the Office of Legal Counsel, not Mr. Gonzalez himself, but another arm of the Justice Department, if the president had the power to order the killing of an al-Qaeda suspect known to be on American soil. What kind of answer did she get?
She got the answer, yes, under certain circumstances. They didn't necessarily enumerate the certain circumstances. And after the fact, the Justice Department said, well, he was just asking hypothetical questions for theoretical contingencies. But they said, yes, the president has the power to do that. And people sympathetic to the administration outlined to me various examples, like what about the administration talking themselves, and supposedly they made the decision in principle anyway, to shoot down that plane, Flight 93, hijacked on September 11th, which it was taken out by the hijackers over towards Cleveland, Ohio, and then turned back in the direction of Washington, D.C. The vice president, as I understand it, actually ordered that the plane should be shot down if it gets too close to Washington, D.C., but of course passengers rebelled and brought the plane down in a field near Pittsburgh before it ever got near Washington, D.C. But the argument is, if Washington, D.C. is imperiled, or if the terrorist is about to set off a bomb somewhere, or for that matter, if the terrorist gets into a firefight with police, should the president be authorized to have that person killed? And I mean, I guess in some circumstances it's hard to argue with.
Just
in other circumstances it might be very easy to argue with.
Depends on what the risk would be in a given situation, I suppose. And
what the risk to the people who are confronting the terrorist are concerned. Yep. If you're talking about sending out death squads to hunt down suspicious people who are sympathetic to Osama bin Laden, that doesn't seem to be a thing that the administration ought to do, and they say that that's not anything that they would think of doing, and I sort of checked further, and I don't see any evidence that they are doing that.
All
on
right.
The other hand, in a crisis situation, they would argue that the president does have the power to do that.
Mark Hosenbaugh with Newsweek. We'll continue to have an entire program tomorrow on this issue, on the hearings, and what might come out of this investigation. Now, Mark, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
On Reporter's Notebook later on, who won the Super Bowl, the Steelers or the officials? In a moment, the free press, cultural sensitivity, and religious fundamentalism on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, I'll be back with To the Point. Last September, the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten challenged cartoonists to draw the Prophet Muhammad, claiming it wanted to test whether the artists would censor themselves due to fear of violence from radical Islamic immigrants in Denmark. Islamic clerics then circulated the drawings in Muslim countries, reportedly adding cartoons that were much more offensive than the originals that were actually published. Since then, angry demonstrations, including violence and death threats, have spread from Europe to the Middle East, to Indonesia and Africa, and other papers in Europe have printed some of the cartoons in solidarity with the idea of a free press. Ibrahim Hooper is National Communications Director for CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And Ibrahim Hooper, good to have you back on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Clear up something, first of all, if you will. To what extent are any kind of visual representations of the Prophet banned by Islam?
Well, Islamic tradition holds that you shouldn't have any visual representations of religious figures. That would include the Prophet Muhammad, Moses, Jesus, anybody of that nature, mainly prophets of God.
Now, aren't there, though, various depictions of Muhammad in particular in widely admired Islamic art?
Yeah, there are some depictions, but typically they will put a veil over his face. They'll have some kind of representation that doesn't show the actual face. And that's to try and avoid the idol worship that can come when you start to have imagery of your religious figures.
Tell us now, why are these particular depictions so offensive? Why have they set off the demonstrations, often with threats of violence and death threats against people all over the world?
Well, I think because they were intended to be offensive. That's the main point. When the original newspaper or the original publisher printed these, it was with the stated intent to offend Muslims. They were like, okay, we'll show you that, you know, people are reluctant to illustrate imagery of the Prophet. We'll do it in such a way that guarantees that you're offended. And then, unfortunately, the Danish government compounded the problem by refusing to meet with representatives of Muslim nations, said basically, as we say, go jump in a lake. And that, I think, created a snowball effect to bring us to this unfortunate situation that we're all in right now.
But in Denmark, the press is free. The government has no restrictions or no power to restrict it at all. How could the Danish government have gone along with that request?
The only request was to meet with the representatives so that they could express the concerns of Muslims worldwide, and they said, we're not even going to do that.
What about the role of the Islamic clerics in Denmark, who reportedly added even more offensive depictions of the Prophet, showing him in compromising sexual situations we don't want to describe on the radio and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I've heard that, but I've typically heard it through right-wing media outlets, and I would have to confirm it myself before I would believe it, because there's a lot of misinformation out there.
There is some evidence, though, if in fact there were many, many Danish flags being destroyed in Gaza, which apparently was the case, you wouldn't normally find Danish flags in Gaza, would you?
I just don't have any information about that.
Okay. So then are you saying that you don't know if in fact extremists within the Muslim religion are fanning the flames, making things worse?
I think the European media is doing a pretty good job of fanning the flames all by itself. And unfortunately, there are those in the Muslim world who offer inappropriate and un-Islamic responses to these kinds of things and go beyond what is legitimate. It's legitimate to protest when your religious figures are defamed intentionally. But that means writing a letter to the editor, write an editorial, peaceful protest in front of an embassy, and even withholding your hard-earned dollars from certain companies, if you wish, but not torching embassies in Damascus or Beirut.
So you would concede, then, that the protests have gone too far?
Yeah, any time there's violence used, that's not appropriate.
Ibrahim Hooper, again, the National Communications Director for CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Arnaud Lévy is managing editor of François. That's a daily newspaper in France, of course, that has republished some of the Danish cartoons. Welcome to you.
Hello.
You had today, as I understand it, a bomb threat at François.
Yes, that's right.
Do you attribute this to the controversy over the cartoons?
Absolutely, unfortunately.
Tell us why you reprinted them.
For a very simple reason. We didn't publish these cartoons because we claimed agreement with the cartoons that we published these cartoons because we claimed agreement for a newspaper in a world of free press in a European democracy to publish them if such is their choice without risking anything else that lawsuit, but certainly without risking to be threatened of death, of violences, of boycott, and more widely for a whole country to be held as collectively responsible and guilty of racism.
Mr. Hooper, a moment ago, said that he thought the protests had gone too far. I'm sure he'd include any sort of bomb threat against your paper as part of that. But he also says he thinks your paper, among others, are fanning the flames.
I'm not sure that's a good way to say things. We have been accused of that very much. We were accused to put oil on fire. My answer would be that it's not by looking elsewhere than the fire that you will let it go out. It's too much honor and responsibility for us to blame us about the Islamic fundamentalist manipulation. In fact, the whole story, I'm afraid, is at the end the result of an alliance of interest between some corrupted and despotic regimes in the Arabian world and Islamic fundamentalists. They have spread the fire. They have put the oil on the fire, and they are trying in the name of a so-called of a respect, which of course is due to religion, to set the limits of the free expression according to religious dogma. This is in no way, and specifically in France, which, as you know, has long tradition of separation between religious beliefs and public affairs, this is no way acceptable in no condition, and whatever the respect is, there can be any other in a democracy limitation to the free expression than those set up by the law.
Arnaud Lévy, again, managing editor of Francois. Back to Ibrahim Hooper with CARE, the Council on American-Islamic Relations. What do you say? Are you calling for limitations on the press due to religious dogma?
No, we have a tremendously free press here in America. We have our First Amendment. We like the First Amendment, freedom of press. But come on, freedom of press and freedom of expression is limited, but it should be limited by common sense and good judgment and respect for others. You can do a lot of things. Doesn't mean you should do a lot of things. You can run into a theater and shout fire. Doesn't mean you should do it. You could publish anti-Semitic or racist cartoons. Doesn't mean you should do it.
Back to Arnaud Lévy. What do you say to that? Why not have limitations?
Well, I wonder if anyone really looked at these cartoons. Of course, the first question we ask ourselves when we knew what was going on is, what was the nature of the journal, of the newspaper who had published them? Was it by any way susceptible of being an extremist far right? Absolutely no. This is a highly respectable newspaper from the center right. Secondly, we watched at the cartoons, and most of them were tasteless, not very interesting, as to be honest, or for the most hurting. That's right. And we did point out that some people who were believers, we understood clearly that it could be offending, but they were not at all, without beyond any reasonable doubt, racist. And this is all the ambiguity of the situation. On the other hand, one thing is not very clear. We do not know if the principle of a newspaper publishing a representation of the Prophet is to be condemned by Muslim and by the so-called common sense, which is a very relative notion you would agree with, or if it's only an offendable nation. So if you try to set up limits to the press, you have to ask according to very subjective and particular reasons like this, you have to ask yourself, where does it begin? Where does it stop? And that's why I understand very well the debate and the issue, and we did not avoid it, of responsibility of the act and so on. But between two dangers, the dangers of too much censorship and the dangers of too much freedom, I would always choose, and I know such is the case in the United States, where everybody does not agree with the State Department analysis on that, I will always choose excess of freedom. There is no way you can risk to jeopardize it.
Again, Arnaud Lévy is managing editor of Francois. Stephen Castle is Europe correspondent for the Independent newspaper in Britain. He is based in Brussels. And Stephen Castle, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
What's your view? And is this the right distinction between too much freedom and too much censorship?
I'm not sure it is the right issue at the moment. I think if you look at what's happened in the United Kingdom, there's been a decision, I think, by almost all the newspapers to avoid reprinting these cartoons. And I think the view has been that whatever view you think of the original decision by Jelens Posten to publish these cartoons, that knowing what we know now, seeing what we see now, it would be irresponsible to exacerbate the situation. It really would be putting fuel on the flames. I mean, it is hard to look around the world, see what we're seeing at the moment in countries right across the world, and say, yes, let's have a little bit more of that.
Again, we're talking with Stephen Castle, Europe correspondent for the Independent newspaper. This is To the Point from PRI. So are you saying then, Stephen Castle, that you would essentially then choose self-censorship, if that's the right term, as opposed to freedom because of what the consequences might be?
Well, I don't think it is a question of censorship. I mean, nobody is saying to the British newspapers, nobody has dreamed of saying to British newspapers or to American newspapers, no, you cannot publish these cartoons. But in fact, newspapers take decisions every single day about whether or not to publish pictures which may offend and upset people, whether this is concerning religion, whether it's concerning photographs of badly injured, maimed, dead people. These are tough decisions that newspapers have to make every single day. And I think maybe from a British perspective, we have quite a lot of sensitivity to Muslim concerns. We have a large Muslim community. And I think we have a sort of historical tradition of having to try to coexist with different faiths in the United Kingdom, whether you're talking about Protestantism and Catholicism in the 16th or 17th century, or Christianity and Islam in the 21st century.
All right, let me go, Stephen Castle, once again with the Independent newspaper. Let me go back to Arnaud Lévy of François. Are you saying that the kind of sensitivity that Mr. Castle is calling for is a kind of a capitulation, even if it does lead to exacerbating the situation?
No, we understand the principle of choosing not to reproduce these cartoons, but we do not think that this should be the single option offered to the press, due, once again, to the contest. My colleague from The Independent was referring to the history. Well, I'm referring to my country's history. And once again, we have a tradition of laughing at everything, and I think English too. And we have specifically a tradition of laughing at religions. This is a right we have. For a very simple reason, we believe generally that laugh is always the enemy of fear. So when you have something like a publication, you have of such a kind, you have to ask what was the reason, what was the aim. And I defy anyone to tell me that my newspaper or newspapers like Die Welt or La Stampa or Spanish newspaper were moved by any racist view. Once again, you can choose not to publish them. You can choose to publish them. What's unacceptable is to be threatened if you publish them. And this is where it all began.
Stephen Castle, I know you need to leave us. Quickly, if you will, respond to what we just heard from Arnaud Lévy.
Well, Arnaud has a good point, but freedom of the press is an extremely precious thing. I just think you have to be careful in the cases in which you push it. This seems to me an extremely difficult and extremely delicate situation. As I say, we have a threat of violence around the world, not just directed at newspapers, but directed at embassies and directed at Western targets. And it seems to me that to inflame this in the cause of freedom of the press is really the wrong decision. These cartoons are not so important to me personally that they're worth the risk of a single life, particularly when you see the cartoons. In fact, the quality of them is, in my view, not particularly exceptional. I think you can make arguments criticizing Islam, calling Islam to account in a much more responsible way.
All right. Stephen Castle again with the Independent newspaper reporting from Brussels. We're going to take a very brief break on Reporter's Notebook. Was the Super Bowl decided by superior play or inferior officiating? Back in a moment with this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the publication and republication in Europe of cartoons depicting The Prophet Muhammad, cartoons which have spurred a firestorm of protest all over the world in Muslim countries with violence and death threats as well, a bomb threat in the case of François. As we just heard from Arnaud Lévy, the editor of that paper is no longer with us, nor is Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Stephen Castle of The Independent, however, is with us, as is Eben Warrock. He is senior research fellow at the Center for Inquiry, an independent think tank that focuses on secular humanist ideas in Buffalo, New York. He's author of Why I Am Not a Muslim, Leaving Islam, and What the Quran Really Says. Eben Warrock, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we just heard from Stephen Castle, that given the extraordinary results that we have seen from publication and now republication of these cartoons, that common sense would require that nobody do it?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not too impressed. I don't know whether it was Mr. Castle who was responsible, but I think this is total and utter hypocrisy. The Independent, in 2003, published a cartoon, Ariel Sharon, biting into the flesh of a Palestinian baby. We had in the background, you have helicopters attacking, firing missiles, and this caption says, "Vote Likud," and Sharon is saying, "What's wrong? You've never seen a politician kissing babies before?" And when the Israelis lodged a complaint, the Independent refused to apologize in any way. They thought everybody was being humorless, and they wrote a reply saying, "Shame on you! We do, why are you taking this all out of context?" I think Mr. Castle and the Independent should be a little bit more honest about their motives. The point, I think, is that they've been bludgeoned into self-censorship out of fear of violence. I think it's a perfectly legitimate fear. Incidentally, I don't think it's irrational. I think it's very, very rational to be afraid of people who are willing to kill you because of their beliefs. So I'm not at all impressed.
Let me go back to Stephen Castle again with The Independent. Is there then a double standard at The Independent and elsewhere?
I think these are completely different cases. I don't really see the connection between them. I really think this is it's a much more serious issue than that last comment would suggest. Don't let's forget, this is about how we deal with minorities, whether we try and integrate them into our society or not. And let's not forget, if you're looking from a British perspective, that we had a terrorist attack last July the 7th, a suicide bomb attack from Muslims who were born and brought up in the United Kingdom. So these questions of how we deal with minorities are really questions of life and death.
Well, but what about the case showing Ariel Sharon biting the baby and asking, "Haven't you ever seen anybody kiss a baby before?" There certainly is a minority of Jews in London.
Well, indeed, but that is exactly the sort of cartoon that is acceptable within the British culture regarding politicians. It's not an anti-Semitic cartoon. It's a cartoon that you could, for example, use portraying Tony Blair or Michael Howard. Michael Howard, the last leader of the Conservative Party, was regularly portrayed as a vampire. That isn't an anti-Semitic. It isn't a racist image. At least it wasn't intended to be. It may have been perceived by some people in that context.
Ibn Warwick, let me go back to you again and have you comment on what we heard earlier, that these are really very different situations, particularly given the very tense state of affairs, not only in Britain, but in the first instance in Denmark, where there is a conservative government in power elected in part on an anti-immigrant platform.
Well, there are different situations. Yes, because the Muslims are ready to kill you if you offend them. I mean, this is nonsense. You cannot. There are all sorts of things in the Islamic belief which offend me, but I don't go around blowing up mosques. Why do they want special treatment? Each time it's the sensitivities of the Muslims. What about the sensitivities of people like me? There are more secularists in Britain than there are Muslims. I mean, something like 25%. percent are said to be without religion. There's a secularist movement which is active and flourishing, and yet nobody asks how they feel about it.
So are secularists then going to be offended in an important way because they're not allowed to see these cartoons?
No. I'm saying that why is it that each time it's always the sensitivities of the Muslims? I mean, the Islamic religion offends me, but I don't go around blowing up mosques. Why is it that each time we have to worry about the sensitivities of the Muslims? Well, we know why, because it leads to violence. And instead for Mr. Castle to pretend it's all because they want to placate, they don't want to offend Muslims and so on, I mean, it's incoherent, totally incoherent.
So, Mr. Castle, back to you then. Is the real issue here the threat of violence rather than anything that has to do with the nuances of multiculturalism?
No, I think this is a completely false argument. There are laws in most countries, and certainly including Britain, against inciting racial hatred. Is that a bad thing? I certainly don't think so. There are things that you can say in any culture, that the things that I could say about British people, which would provoke a very, very bad reaction. But I think once one crosses the line in terms of inciting racial hatred, racist comments, xenophobic comments, journalism which is designed to exacerbate a tense situation, to make people feel uncomfortable, then one crosses the line of responsibility.
Mr. Warak, your response to that?
No, Islam is not a race. You cannot be racist by criticizing Islam. Satire is a very long tradition in Western culture, from Lucilius, Lucian, Petronius, Quintilian onwards. This is a very important a weapon in the armor of journalists, writers. We have perfect right to criticize any and every religion. This is a right that was won with a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and we are right to defend it. And I think the British press should have been a little bit more courageous. They haven't shown a great deal of backbone in the past either, especially when it came to the Rushdie affair. And in this case, they've shown even less. They should show solidarity with the Danish cartoonists. Freedom of the press is a fundamental freedom, and unless people stand up and fight for this freedom, we're going to have the Islamization of Europe coming pretty quick within the next 25 years. So I think Mr. Castle has just not been honest for the reasons why people like the journals like the Independent are censoring themselves.
Let me move on to American papers. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, which last did a survey yesterday, that being Sunday, most American news outlets still have declined to publish the drawing. Several U.S. broadcast outlets, again according to the Tribune, have showed full or partial images of some of the cartoons. The New York Daily Sun published two of the cartoons last Thursday. Some conservative blogs and websites have posted the drawings. The Philadelphia Inquirer's website had a link to the cartoons, and one cartoon did appear in that paper as well. Tom Rosenstiel is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, funded by the Pew Charitable Trust. He's also worked at the LA Times and the Washington and Newsweek magazine as a reporter. Tom Rosenstiel, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Do you think more American publications will publish the cartoons?
Well, their instinct is obviously not to, and that's part of a growing trend in American newspapers away from satire and cartooning. But if this becomes a bigger and bigger story, it becomes harder to argue that the cartoons themselves are not news, and then you get to that difficult point of how do you talk about something that's news without actually showing it to people.
What are the standards you apply? At what point do you decide, okay, this is news? There have been demonstrations all over the world and deaths in several countries, not people who were attacked because they were supporting the cartoons, but, as I understand it, ancillary incidents having to do with the protest.
Well, you know, obviously the protests themselves and the reaction of the cartoons have already become news and are getting pretty heavy play in American papers. The question that the journalists ask themselves is, okay, can we communicate what this is about without actually showing the cartoon itself? And the bigger that this story becomes, the more difficult that question becomes, because the more detailed the coverage has to be. And, you know, when this was a small story on Friday, you could simply argue against showing the cartoons on the basis of space and avoid the more difficult questions about do we want to show these things or not.
I want to get back to the question of the trend away from satire, but before I do, let me go back quickly to Stephen Castle, who I know does need to leave us. Stephen Castle is gone. Let me go back then to Eben Warrick, again with the Center of Inquiry near Buffalo, himself author of Why I Am Not a Muslim, Leaving Islam, and What the Quran Really Says. I want to make clear where Mr. Warrick is coming from. What about this question of deciding when it's finally news? Is that, do you think, a legitimate question? Or do you think American papers ought to show solidarity with the issue of the free press?
Yes, I would have liked to have seen a great deal more solidarity. Indeed, yes. I think whether it's newsworthy or not, that's a journalistic decision. I think there should have been a bit more fundamental decision of showing solidarity with the Danish cartoonists, indeed.
Tom Rosensteel, I don't know if this is within your purview as a press student, but there are conservatives around the country, columnists, bloggers, and others who are saying, as Ibn Warrick did a moment ago, that the weakness of free societies is being displayed here in the face of militant Islam and the kind of violent attacks that we have seen, and the threats and the bomb scare today at Francois, which we talked about earlier with Arnaud Levy, the editor of that paper. How much is all that, do you think, affecting American journalistic decisions?
I don't think there's any question, Warren. I mean, you know, even the credo of the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, in that verb fit, there are many calculations. You know, one of the things that newspapers have dealt with from the beginning is what are community standards and how far do we want to lead the community as well as, reflect the community. And I don't think that there's any journalist in the country, if he were being or she candid about it, who would deny that in an environment where where press credibility has been declining now for almost two decades, and conservatives in particular have been very harshly critical and openly critical of the press for being politically liberal, whether that's a sincere concern in all cases or a tactical argument. Journalists are defensive, and they're worried about offending the community, alienating more audience. It's possible to alienate audience on political grounds today and have them flee to other competitors who are offering a more congenial political atmosphere for readers and listeners. And so this is why, to get back to this other question of the sort of the general trend, we've seen not just the decline, but really the gradual death of political cartooning in American newspapers, because they can really shock people. The very thing that made them powerful and popular a century ago makes them dangerous and worrisome for papers today. I also don't think, Warren, it's complete coincidence that we're seeing people post these things online or link to them online, but not publish them in the print edition, because there's more sense that you can link to anything online and that it's actually you're simply being transparent about something by giving people access to it when you're not actually posting it yourself. There's a different sort of sensibility about it, and no one seems to want to, it's hard to know who to be to attack other than rhetorically if it's simply done online.
Tom Rosensteel with the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Back to Ibn Warraq. Let me ask you this question. You are a former Muslim, and you have written about that extensively. To what extent do you think the kind of reaction that we have seen represents Islam as a whole? Isn't it really a very few people that are involved? And if these controversies continue and the cartoons are published where there is already resentment against immigrants just for being immigrants, do you think that not just Muslims but the people who might be taken for Muslims are put at risk?
In the West... Yes, indeed. But the reactions in the Islamic world, it's a good question as to whether they represent everybody in Islamic societies. That's another question altogether. But as I think it was Christopher Hitchens who pointed out, it's a bit absurd to think that the first lynch mob on the scene, it's absurd to take them as representing the true Islam and so on. I noticed in another context, a couple of people who, in fact, defended freedom of speech within the Islamic world. There was Professor Hilal Kashan, who was hoping that these incidents will push Muslims to start debating about true Islam, about reforming Islam, and so on. And the other one was a Saudi blogger who was saying, come off it. We're asking for special treatment each time. It's not really about the Prophet at all. It's always me, and my sensibilities. We are insulted. Why do they do this to us? And so on. So there are signs that there are liberals who don't react in such an extremist way. But you cannot blame cartoonists for whipping up anti-immigrant issues. That's really there are laws in place which would defend the rights of immigrants and so on.
All right, that's all the time we have at the moment. Ibn Warraq, thank you very much for being with us, senior research fellow at the Center for Inquiry. And Tom Rosensteel, thanks to you for being with us. I'd like to pursue this question of satire and cartoons in American publications on another program later. Thanks also to Stephen Castle with The Independent, Arnaud Lévy of François, and Ibrahim Hooper of the Council on American Islamic Relations. This is To the Point from PRI. The Super Bowl is finally over, but the controversy lingers on. It's not about the athletes, though. It's about the officials. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Statistics show that the Seattle Seahawks outplayed the Pittsburgh Steelers yesterday by holding the ball longer, gaining more yards. But the Steelers came away with a victory, 21-10. NFL critics around the country are saying they can thank the officials. John Lindsay is a sports reporter for the Scripps Howard News Services. Good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
A couple of plays particularly are being looked at. First, there was a touchdown that the Seahawks made that got called back. Then there was a touchdown the Steelers were given, which a lot of people say the replay showed they didn't actually make. Do you think the officials really decided this game?
Well, I think the officials were a clear deciding factor in it, but to say they decided the game, I think that's a little bit of hyperbole. Seattle was the highest scoring team in the NFL this year, and they managed only 10 points. They somehow turned almost 400 yards of offense into 10 points, and when you do that, you're not likely to win a lot of games.
Yeah, but they might have had another touchdown if, in fact, that play hadn't been called back.
Yeah, I think it basically boiled down to me probably two calls that were just absolute backbreakers. Statistically, the penalties weren't too bad. It was seven on Seattle for 70 yards, which is not a high number, but there was only three on Pittsburgh for 20 yards. But it's a time when these happen. The first one, the first touchdown in this game was going to be key because of the way both teams like to run the ball and to use the clock. And if Seattle had scored on that first touchdown, which they did until the referee called a very, very strange offensive pass interference call, I think that could have really changed the way the game was played, and it might have given Seattle, it would have given Seattle a far better chance of winning. The second one was late in the third and early in the fourth quarter when Seattle was moving perhaps for a go-ahead touchdown, and they threw a pass to the one-yard line to Jeremy Stevens, their tight end, and that was called back on another holding penalty, which was very, very, very questionable. So that's 14 points probably that were taken away from Seattle, and they lost by 11. So it's pretty easy to make that assumption that the referees had a lot to do with it.
What about the one-yard run that the Pittsburgh quarterback made that a lot of people say didn't, in fact, get across the goal line, but which they got credit for?
Yeah, that was strange, and that they had a replay on that, and it seemed to show that Ben Roethlisberger, the Pittsburgh quarterback, did not get to the goal line with the ball. But it was strange. I was having a party at my house watching the game, and most people thought he didn't get into the end zone, but some thought he did, because you have to remember that the goal line extends upward, you know, vertically. You don't have to touch the ball to the goal line or anything. If any part of the ball touches the goal line, it's a touchdown. Personally, I didn't think that he did. It would have been fourth down and inside the one, so Pittsburgh still might have scored there. Probably, I would say, would have. And so I don't think that was as bad as the other two, although that one was reviewed by the officials, and, you know, it could have been reversed.
Again, we're talking with John Lindsay, who's sports writer for the Scripps Howard News Service. Well, does that suggest, then, that all these calls are these calls are frequently very subjective? Is it then worth the argument that the NFL ought, like the baseball leagues, to have professional umpires?
I think there's been a large deal of sentiment for that over the last 5 or 10 years, but the league seems very resistant to do it. I think that's for two main reasons. One, it would take a pretty sizable financial investment. These guys make, I think, somewhere along $3,000 or $5,000 to do it, which sounds like a lot. But they have other jobs, so if you're going to get them to be officials, they'd have to quit these other pretty lucrative jobs for a lot of them, and that'd be a sizable investment. And the second thing is, the way that they're not full-time officials, that they work as bankers, as policemen, whatever, it harkens back to a simpler time in the league. And up until these last few years, the league's been mostly pleased, I think, with the quality of the officiating. So there's a question, why change?
Who are these people? Elaborate a bit. Bankers, policemen, business people?
Yeah, they're just, it could be the person next to you in the grocery store line. You would never know. But they're people that basically work their way up through the ranks. They start probably officiating some high school games. They go to college and do some more college games. And then eventually the league tends to kind of go out and recruit them and again, offer them more pay and better accommodations and whatnot for working in the NFL.
I would assume, too, there's an argument that the NFL doesn't play that many games, certainly by comparison to the baseball league, which goes on for a long, long time.
Yeah, as does basketball in the NBA. Which
same thing.
They have their own officials. And I think that's the point here that some people are missing. And this is, in my recollection, one of the first Super Bowls, I think, where people have really turned and said, oh, my gosh, the refs really affected the outcome of the game. Again, I don't think it was entirely that, but this is kind of common in the NBA, particularly when Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant were playing for the Lakers. There was a widespread conspiracy belief from a lot of people that the league, because Shaq and Kobe were from Los Angeles, a huge market, they would always favor them to win. And a lot of people got disgusted with it, and some people didn't even watch the games. And you saw the ratings plummet for the NBA Finals for a while.
Back to the football playoffs and the Super Bowl being the final culmination of those, I take it that there's been criticism all during the playoff game.
Yeah, the playoffs, this playoffs was one of the worst officiated I think I've ever seen. There was just a number of gaffes where particularly the 3 weeks ago, the Pittsburgh-Indianapolis AFC semifinal game, where there was a very questionable reversal of interception call, and it got so bad that Joey Porter, the Steelers linebacker, basically said that the league wanted Peyton Manning and the Colts to win. And even though he said this, he was not fined for it. It's like the league almost admitted that the officiating was that bad, and they're just going to have to let the guy kind of slide on what he said.
What about the preference for the Steelers? I know a lot of people in Seattle think that the league itself wanted the Steelers to win. Certainly the crowd did in the stadium in Detroit.
Yeah, I think Pittsburgh's a much more established franchise. You're talking about a team that goes back to the 1930s and the 1970s, won four Super Bowls with Terry Bradshaw, Mean Joe Green, the Steel Curtain defense, and has much more of a national following than Seattle, which is basically basically pretty much been to put politely, nondescript franchise for a long time now, and finally had its shot at the big time. And some Seahawks fans, I'm sure, believe that they were fighting 12 and 13 men out there on the field the way the officials were treating them.
Well, the franchise may be newer in Seattle, but that's a booming community. They certainly want to support the audience there, don't they, the people in the league?
I think they would, especially when you consider you got a guy like Paul Allen owning the team who's got more money than, I guarantee you, than the Rooneys do in Pittsburgh. But it's just a situation where, it's just perception. I mean, everyone talked in the 2 weeks up to the game how great Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger was, how Jerome Bettis, their old running back, was retiring, and Bill Cowher, the coach. We all want to see the Steelers win. And then when the game turns out the way it does, I could see how Seattle fans would feel that they, may have gotten cheated in their opinion. But again, I don't think the facts of the game really hold up to that level.
Was it a good game?
No, it was not a good game. It was, if you were grading this game, you might give it a C-, but that and even that's being kind. The first 20 minutes were about as dull football as you'll ever see. And that, I think, may have been when Seattle lost the game, because they were getting the best of the play but didn't generate enough points. They were the highest-scoring team in the league, and they didn't do enough when they seemed to have the better part of it. There was a couple good plays. Game-clinching touchdown when Pittsburgh's wide receiver Randall L. threw off a gadget play, a touchdown, was a very well-played play, as was the Willie Parker touchdown run early in the second half. But by and large, no, this will not even crack the top, I'd say, 30 Super Bowls all time out of 40.
A lot of people say the Super Bowl is often not very interesting.
Yeah, it has been historically, it has been a real downer. Lately, it had gotten a lot better. The games, particularly with the New England Patriots, were all decided by a field goal, and most of them late in the game. But it has, if you look back historically, especially in the 1990s and much of the 1980s, games were routinely 55 to 10, 42 to 10. They were just, these things were over by halftime.
All right. Well, it certainly tells you something about this one if the big story after the game is the officiating rather than
the game itself.
John Lindsay, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Sports writer, Scripps Howard News Service. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Katie Cooper and Jonah King, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Marvin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.